Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 2 p.m. and that is Pacific Standard Time. Today is November 29th and today being Friday, it's the big picture long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. Well, I thought we'd kick off this week and address two of the things that I think people are worried about. The first is that there was news earlier on in the week that Bridgewater had amassed a short position by taking out a large number of put options on the S&P 500 in the order of about $150 million, which would have paid off a very significant quantity if the market had in fact declined, or it does decline over the next 6 weeks. Some people thought that was a clear piece of evidence that they are starting to get net short. The likelihood, however, is that it is probably more to do with the interplay between the VIX and the MOVE index. And when we think about what does that look like, well, I think it's really rather instructive to look at what does a risk parity strategy really look like? How do they size their trades? This is one of the most important things I think most people just don't have a handle on. It's really when you go to create an algorithmic trading system, you can input any way you want about how to pick what to invest in. But there are really only a very limited number of ways in which you can size your positions. Risk parity is using the correlation between bonds and equities to create what's I think often reflected as an optimal portfolio. But they compare the volatility of those two asset classes and then they use that comparison to size the relative positions of bonds versus equities. Well, we can look at the volatility of equities and of the bond market, and we can look at it over really quite a lot of history. What we can definitely see is that the more history we look at, the more examples we have of occasional spikes. And these occasional spikes have generally resulted in buying opportunities for equities, and most particularly buying opportunities of equities relative to bonds. Now, if one were to have a short position in the VIX relative to a long position in the MOVE index, which is the volatility on bonds, then you'd be anticipating that this ratio is going to bounce. That doesn't necessarily mean that you are short equities, but rather that it's you're playing the relative value of equity market volatility versus bond market volatility. And there have been occasions when it has got down to 0.15, and subsequent to that, we've had bounces. I suspect that that is what is the rationale behind this move by Bridgewater. It seems to be reasonably certain that they are playing the volatility between the two asset classes, because that's integral to the risk parity strategy that the firm pioneered in the first place. So when people see the headline, oh, Bridgewater, Ray Dalio, who has been saying that we are in a period analogous to the late 1930s and that has been advising people to accumulate gold, is now short of the stock market, well, obviously then it gets people rather panicky. But then he came out within a very short period of time, it was probably half a day, and said, no, they're not net short. So there must have been some other explanation for it. I think this ratio probably gives us about the closest thing to a rational explanation without, in fact, having a clear insight into exactly what is the Bridgewater strategy from an internal basis. We won't ever really know that, I'm sure. But I think this is at least a reasonable prognostication. Then I think there was the other story that's been going around, and it's about the fact that this margin debt figure has been declining. And margin debt has been something that has been a really very reliable indicator of trouble in the stock market over a very lengthy period of time. The problem, however, is that the NYSE stopped issuing its margin debt figures in 2017. So I sent out a request for subscribers if they had information about where these people were getting their margin debt figures from to perhaps let me know. Well, somebody sent through this chart from the Felder report. I would very clearly hasten to add that this is a ratio. It's margin debt to GDP. It's, excuse me, I need to sneeze. Excuse me. And when we look at the ratio, well, it has been pretty much going sideways for most of the last 5 years. Well, what that really says is that the appetite for risk relative to GDP growth has been moderating over the course of the last 5 years. But stock markets continue to move higher. Now, that's not normal. That's not something that we would anticipate. So there must be something else going on. It either means that the ratio previously told us that there was a high correlation between appetite for risk and GDP growth, and then when GDP growth peaked, margin debt started to decline even faster. Well, what we're now seeing is that the GDP growth is still steady, but appetite for risk has been moderating over the last 5 years. That is, I think, rather interesting because it's really very similar to this chart, which is the total profits. And I think that's even more important than margin debt. When we look at corporate profits, it was updated for the end of September this week, and it was pretty flat. But the most important thing is that it's been pretty much going sideways for most of the last 5 years. And this is equally a really important indicator of previous peaks in the lead indicator for previous peaks in the stock market, because it peaked in 2006, well ahead of the financial crisis, and it also peaked in 1997, 2 years ahead of the dot-com bust. Well, it peaked in 2014, and it has been pretty staid ever since. I find it particularly interesting that margin debt to GDP ratio looks almost identical to this pattern over the course of the last 5 years. Well, what it's telling us is that there is something else that is providing even more of an influence on the market. I would also like to discuss for a moment the very clear fact that there is now a cottage industry in developing lead indicators for future recessions. And I've been compiling a list of them on my computer because I think that it is quite interesting to try and look at some of these. So, for example, just in the last week, I've seen these four. You have Commerzbank showing that there is an elevated risk that we're moving towards recessionary conditions, but that we're not there yet. There is this chart, which was from Goldman, and it was highlighting that when we look at the high yield ex commodities sector, then that spreads are starting to widen out. So then that is considered to be a lead indicator that spreads might be widening out. This is another example of this margin debt and S&P. But again, I don't know where Yardini has been getting this data. Again, it looks like another example of this margin debt to GDP question. Again, I think that one thing that we've never seen previously has been the continued outperformance of the stock market when margin debt has been declining. Given the fact that the NYSE is no longer producing it and that the FINRA data, even the combined FINRA data, does not marry up with the historic statements that we have from the Bloomberg data for margin debt, I'm rather slow to accept that this is a reliable data set going forward from 2017. And considering the strength that we have in the stock markets, well, then that does support that we're still in a bull market environment. This is another chart that I think is interesting, though. And it is the number of countries that have got a yield lower than the USA. And we don't see that very often. In fact, when we think about the fact that there was a point in here this year where 100% of developed market bonds were trading at yields below that of the US Treasury, then we know that we are in a very odd set of circumstances. But it is perhaps that very odd set of circumstances which is helping to sustain the bull market that we have on Wall Street, because we definitely have a very clear breakout. When we'll just simply look at the chart action, we've had three 18-month consolidations, and the market has broken up and out of the most recent of those. In this period over the last decade, I'm just going to take off the news so that we get a bigger chart. We can see that this has been a very persistent advance. There have been a clear consistency with a staircased step sequence uptrend. If we then look at adding instead of a 40-week, but rather a 200-week moving average, well, then what we're presented with is clear evidence that in a secular bull market, the 1,000-day moving average or 200-week moving average is an area of support. And that was equally the case during the last bull market, where it was all the way up from 1982 that the 1,000-day moving average represented an area of support, and it was from about 1994 onwards that it became very clear that we were getting into a much steeper period of advance. Well, when we look at this bull market that we've been presented with over the last decade, we now have a wide overextension relative to that 1,000-day moving average. I think that is why we need to start paying more attention to the 200-day moving average, because it is during these periods of consistent trending environments that the 200-day moving average becomes much more important. It's during the ranging phases, and particularly the medium-term corrections that punctuate secular bull markets, that the 1,000-day moving average becomes more important. Well, we've had the breakout. Now, there is no doubt that the move we've had has been really rather spectacular, that there has been a very clear move on the upside, and we're seeing it not just on the S&P 500, but we're seeing it on an increasingly large number of the primary indices. The NASDAQ has been leading on the upside. The semiconductors index has been leading the NASDAQ. And there is obviously a clear overextension on the semiconductors index. It is worth highlighting, though, that semiconductors tend to be highly cyclical, and we are now starting to see a return to dominance of highly cyclical sectors. That was led by the semiconductors index. We are now starting to see the return to performance of the biotechnology sector, and this is one of the few remaining parts of the technology sector which has not been affected by the subscription business model, and it also remains really quite highly cyclical. It has clearly broken the year-long downtrend. It's been up on consecutive weeks. It was up again in here this week. What we are starting to see is that the beaten down immuno-oncology sector is starting to catch a bid in here. It has been up now for 8 consecutive weeks. This is being led, for example, by I think I was looking at the Clovis Oncology chart earlier on, and here today, that had pulled back extremely violently off the peak in 2017, but it's been up now for four consecutive weeks. This was another big move in here today. Well, what we're seeing is that there is a clear move in terms of the large pharmaceutical companies trying to buy up intellectual property. If we look at some of the CRISPR companies, Intellia, for example, has bounced from the $10 area and is up rather dynamically over just the last month. When we look at Editas, and I've got the wrong ticker for that, when we look at Editas Medicine, then it's got a very similar pattern. It's bouncing and breaking out, in fact, of the base that's been put in over the last year. And CRISPR Therapeutics has been leading on the upside. And it is now pushing back up towards the peak put in the middle of last year. The reason that the CRISPR shares are doing better, despite the still acrimonious dispute about intellectual property, is because we're entering the period where human trial results are in fact starting to come good. And this represents a massive transition in terms of the global healthcare sector. It is the, if I think perhaps the best way to think about it is that if the subscription business model was revolutionary for the technology sector, because it streamlined what had previously been cyclical cash flows and turned them into the kinds of reliable income streams that one would associate with consumer staples, that has transformed the businesses of companies like Adobe, all the way through to Microsoft, and many, many companies in between. In the pharmaceutical sector, they have been relying for decades on the reliable income streams from chronic conditions. But what we are now starting to look at is cures. And pharmaceutical pricing and drug pricing represents a really incredibly significant tax on consumption. It's also a massive source of a spending source for government and for national health services. If we are moving towards an environment where we're not just thinking about the extraordinary costs involved in creating custom solutions and creating cures rather than treatments for what are essentially orphan diseases, but with these proof of concepts coming through that these genetic solutions can be used for not simply these diseases that had previously been killing people, but rather for the chronic conditions, the really expensive ones like diabetes and arthritis and the extremely long-term expensive conditions that people are really plagued with. That frees up incredible resources that can be redeployed to deal with more pressing issues. And this is something that could potentially revolutionize the healthcare sector, because if they can make cures available to common ailments, then that is something that can potentially be profitable for these companies. Right now, because of the small sample space and the limited number of people who have the diseases, then it's very difficult to make money, and that commands a very high price. The bigger the market, the lower the price can be. And of course, that's one of the reasons why vaccines are so cheap. It's because everybody gets them, or at least everybody should be getting them. Well, when we then think about what that is likely to do in terms of global growth, it is something that could be potentially really incredibly important. When we look at what is going on in the wider world, one of the reasons why we're getting this continued advance in the stock market, then it's largely because of this incredible reversal in US monetary policy. I think what's rather interesting right now is that the Chinese central banker about 2 years ago was fearful of a Minsky moment in China, that they were looking at property prices and economic growth that had been persistent for 20 years and thinking that leverage was building up, that the consumers were taking on a lot more leverage, that the debt loads were increasing rather precipitously, and that it represented a clear and existential threat to the health of the domestic economy, and perhaps more importantly to the global ambitions of the Communist Party to take over. Since then, they have tried to stamp out the shadow banking sector. They have curtailed additional sources of income for the regional banking sector. They have refused to pull the traditional levers for growth, which would be infrastructure development and the additional building of residential units. I mean, residential units, at the moment there are 50 million vacant apartments in China. If that doesn't say that they've got plenty of accommodation already, nothing does. What they are clearly trying to do is to avoid a Minsky moment. They're trying to deliver the economy. That is contributing to slower growth, and it's increasingly likely that growth is below 6% at exactly the same time that inflationary pressures are mounting. So certainly China has got some significant issues. Of course, when we then think about what is the USA doing? Well, they are increasing the size of their balance sheet. They have now added $300 billion to that total, and it was up again in here this week. They have reduced their they've reduced interest rates. So far, there's been three reductions since July alone. They're down to 1.75%, and the federal government is running a deficit in excess of $1 trillion. Well, if that can't create a bull market in the stock market, probably not much can. And that's what we're getting. These are incredibly pro-cyclical policies. Of course, when a country runs these kinds of pro-cyclical policies, anyone with any sense is probably thinking, well, golly, this can't last indefinitely, that eventually we're going to see that all of the debt that's been taken out is eventually going to have to get paid back, and people start to think, well, obviously there must be a problem. That's pretty similar to the conclusion that the Chinese had arrived at, and they've instituted this fiscal and monetary austerity over the course of the last while. Of course, that is austerity by Chinese standards. They certainly haven't been contracting the monetary base, but they aren't increasing it aggressively either. When we look at 10-year government bond yields, there is still an uptrend. We still have a sequence of higher reaction lows, and it has just about unwound all of the overextension relative to the trend mean. It has clearly bounced from the 1.5% level. Again, this is the third instance in the course of the last decade, and on each of those occasions we saw a significant move in yields higher. Perhaps the biggest and most significant lead indicator for a future recession is the yield curve spread, and it did get negative for a very brief time approximately 1 week in August, and that is something that is worth considering because it has been such a, I think, reliable lead indicator for future problems. I think it is, though, worth highlighting that there are some important aspects of the yield curve that are worth considering. The first is that it is a lead indicator that can be anything from 6 to 18 months in duration. It isn't usually until we start to see the yield curve starting to surge higher that we need to be truly alert to the potential for stock markets to roll over. We also know that the original inversion in 1998, we didn't really start to see those that yield curve spread starting to race higher until the latter half of 2000. And between 1998 and the peak, the market went up 50%. We had the original inversion in 2005, and it wasn't until the middle of 2007 that the market, that the spread started to really accelerate higher. And in between those two periods, the market went up 30%. Well, we've seen that we've had the first inversion. Now, the question is, when is it that this yield curve spread is going to start shooting higher, and most particularly pushing up and through the 50 basis point level in a dynamic manner? That's when we need to be truly aware of what the risks are. But in between now and then, there is the clear potential that we're going to get a more benign environment in the stock market, particularly in view of the history of what happens following an inversion, that generally speaking, you get the rest of the bull market climaxing quite soon, or I think quite near to the time when the market starts to, or the spread, I should say, starts to surge higher. Then when we look at the global market, well, the European, the Euro Stoxx Index has been going sideways for the better part of 20 years. And it is now pushing up towards this 400 level, and it looks better supported around this area than it has done for really quite some time. When we look at Japan, the Nikkei continues to look like it is consolidating above the 20,000 level, and it is now back testing the upper side of that range. So we do have some potential for pause and consolidation in this area. When, for example, we look at Australia, then the stock market index has been supported by the weakness of the Australian dollar, but it was at a new all-time high at an earlier point this week. When we then cast our attention to the currency markets, then the US dollar has been among the strongest currencies in the world, but most particularly against the commodity producers and some of the Asian currencies, and a lot of that has to do with what's going on in China. The renminbi continues to distribute around the 7 level. I think it's really very unlikely that we're going to see a substantial strengthening through 7, because China just can't afford to have a strong currency when the growth situation domestically is moderating to such an incredible extent. When we then think about the continuous commodity index, it had got up to the test, or it got up enough to break the year-long downtrend. Now it's back around the 400 level. If it's going to find support around here, then it really needs to be getting about it. I think the most important point is that this has been a very rangy environment over the course of the last 3 years. The commodity complex is extremely heavily influenced by what goes on in China, because it represents such an incredible demand story. Well, if when we look at what happened in terms of the stock market in here today in Hong Kong, it was down over 500 points in a really quite a dynamic manner. We've had a preponderance of dynamic moves over the course of the last 4 months. There have been up and downward dynamics. And it's coming back now to test the region of the trend mean. But the succession of higher reaction lows, it's encountered resistance in the region of the trend mean. If we're going to see this as a period of support building, the 25,000 point level absolutely needs to hold. We can also see that the 1,000 day moving average is right around where the price is, but when we look at it on the 40 week moving average, it has just encountered resistance in the region of the trend mean. Hong Kong is now heavily influenced by the constituents of the index are those that are big mainland companies. HSBC is still the second largest holdings, but AIA Group and Tencent and China Construction Bank are clearly dominating. Tencent was the darling of investors in 2017, but it has held a downtrend all of this year, and it was coming back off the region of the trend mean again in here this week. It really does have to push back above the trend mean in order to break the downtrend and to clearly suggest that we're back in a demand-dominated environment. And that's a big ask. Now, when we look at the Shenzhen B-Share Index, it broke downwards yesterday and followed through on the downside in here today. And again, this is a bearish chart pattern. It suggests that the weakness that we have in China is not about to go away in the short term. They need to start to stimulate. Oil prices got right back up to test the $65 area and have failed in here. Now, the upward bias is still intact. There has been a two-month sequence of higher reaction lows, and that is still intact. We've had a much more dynamic move on West Texas Intermediate, and it is right in the region of its higher reaction lows. It's going to have to bounce on Monday. I think the more important point, though, is the reason behind these dynamic moves is because OPEC Plus has been clearly stating that they aren't particularly keen on curtailing the supply of oil. So that does suggest we are at a point now where oil prices could either rally from here if OPEC changes its mind at its meeting next week, or we see some additional efforts to support the price. If we don't see additional efforts to support the price, then there is clear potential that we're going to see this rangy environment persist, and additional potential for lower to lateral ranging manifest. Lower energy prices are obviously really quite beneficial to consumers, most particularly because the burden from additional regulations and additional taxation on gasoline and energy is a headwind to additional consumption. So lower energy prices would certainly be beneficial. We are definitely seeing, though, that there is a clear change going on in terms of the global mobility sector. On the one hand, oil prices are relatively well contained. Natural gas prices are really quite low, and we're down in a dynamic manner again in here this week. When we look at natural gas, not just over the course of the last few days, but over the course of the last 20 odd years, Well, we can see that it is one of the few commodities that is even close to approximating the levels that existed before the big commodity boom that really started in about 2000. There is ample supply. Economics 101 would suggest that when there is ample supply of an essential economic commodity, that demand will increase. Well, Qatar announced in here this week that they are going to massively increase their export capacity for LNG. Right now, Australia has got almost as much export capacity as Qatar. The USA became a net petroleum exporter this month. They are already exporting natural gas. There is a huge amount of gas out on the global market now looking for a home. Pollution in much of Southeast Asia, particularly the highest population and highest growth markets, is creating demand for gas as the standard of living for millions of people continues to improve, then demand for gas will also increase. Well, that's beneficial in terms of the market generally. There is plenty of it around at present, and that could put further downward pressure on prices. It's likely that we're going to see some bankruptcies. Chesapeake, for example, has been pulling back extremely violently over the course of this month and going from 160 to 60 in a month is really quite a profound move. What it also suggests, though, is that not just are we going to see conventional uses for gas improve or grow, but that we'll get additional sources of demand emerging as well. And that could potentially be from the transportation sector in terms of hydrogen fuel cells, or it could be from the food sector. We are going to have an additional 2 to 3 billion people in the world over the course of the next 50 years before the peaking of the birth rate gets really felt in terms of the global population. That is going to represent a significant additional demand on food, and there is going to be a clear need for fertilizers, and natural gas is certainly one of those. But of course, there are additional scientific improvements that are occurring where they can create organic compounds directly from gas, and that is also something that is likely to become a more significant factor, and not least because of lab-grown meats. I've seen some of the technological announcements that they can literally turn gas directly into proteins, and if that's the case, then we are literally going to be eating fossil fuels at some point over the course of the next decade. Again, these are the kinds of additional use cases that emerge in a phenomenally low-priced environment. Then we have the technological changes. The fact that Tesla has got cars on the road today that have already driven 1 million miles, losing only 1% of their charging capacity, that tells us that one of the primary arguments against having an electric vehicle over the course of the last few years was that the batteries lost their charging capacity within the space of about 2 years, and the resale value of those cars was the worst in the market. There is the real possibility today that by buying a Tesla, one might never have to buy another car. And obviously, some people will always want to have a new car. They will always want the new car feeling, the new car smell, and the status of having a new car, but it won't be a necessity. And again, that is a phenomenal change. Well, it's almost exactly the same argument in mobility as we're getting in healthcare. there is the real potential that companies today can produce cars that will essentially last a lifetime, in much the same way that in the healthcare sector, they are producing cures rather than treatments. Because today, when one buys a petrol vehicle that really starts to give trouble at around 80 or 90,000 miles, then that is more of a chronic mobility condition rather than a cure for our mobility demands. There is the obvious corollary that some of the automotive producers are not going to survive this. There is already a clear trend of consolidation, and we're already seeing that Fiat, Chrysler, Peugeot, Nissan are merging. Tata Motors is looking for a partner to try and pioneer its own electric vehicle production. But it's the producers of batteries are perhaps most likely to benefit. It's the battery is by far the most valuable portion of the electric car. Lithium prices have been coming down because we've already had the mining boom in terms of lithium. For example, when we look at Orocobre, they had their annual general meeting this week, but didn't really announce anything that would break the downtrend. The peak at about $7.50 feels like an awfully long time ago when something's been trending downwards for 2 years and has given up two-thirds of its value in that time. What this is clearly telling us is that when, for example, we look at the move in lithium or the move that we've had in cobalt, where the entire bull market has been unwound, it is actually nickel is the metal that should do best from new battery chemistries, but it broke downwards in here this week. It could have found support in the region of the trend mean and failed to do so. And part of the reason for that is because supply is starting to come into the market now. Part of the reason that it popped on the upside in the middle of the year was because of export restrictions from Indonesia. Well, that challenge now seems to be ebbing away. But, of course, the other point is about automotive demand, and the slowing Chinese economy is another part of that equation. It's not just about technology. The technology is already a massive interruption in terms of the global supply chain for the automotive sector. But their demand growth forecasts, upon which all of their previous investments in plant and machinery had been based, are also starting to fall apart because of the slowdown that we're getting in China. That's a massive challenge. It is a two-pronged challenge for these companies, and some of them may survive, but there will be some that simply will fail. It's really all down to governance and the ability to see where the technological frontier is. The Indian market was a little weaker in here today, and growth has been moderating. When we look at the 10-year yield, it's pricing in the potential for additional rate cuts. The Indian administration is engaged in fiscal stimulus. There is the clear potential that the central bank will follow through and start cutting interest rates, so that will be an additional source of support. But the most important thing is that the Modi administration is now clearly following through on its mandate. They were given a majority in both the lower and upper houses, and they are pushing through the kinds of reforms that people have been crying out for decades. And labour market reforms in here this week are following up on the nationalisation of some of the non-bank lenders, the clear attempts to try and clean that sector up, the cutting of the corporate tax rate, the consolidation of the big state-owned banks, the privatization initiatives that are being introduced, the streamlining of labor laws is something that is very welcome. All of these factors are likely to contribute to renewed economic growth in the not so distant future. And India has got democracy, but more important than democracy, it has got an independent judiciary, it's got a free press, it's got property rights, and it's got a well-developed stock market. So all of these factors contribute to not only our ability to look for improving standards of governance, but gives us a way of measuring that governance. China doesn't have any of those factors. The one thing that it had done was produce outsized economic growth. What we are now starting to see is, I think, a transition. And the big question that is outstanding is whether the Chinese administration will in fact succeed in trying to moderate the bubble that has evolved in private capital and leverage in their economy over the course of the last decade. Well, if they fail, it's probably going to take the commodity complex with it. They do seem to be doing just enough to ensure that economic growth is ticking along. When we think about what is likely over the next year, the continued advance of the dollar index is supportive of the view that investors still view Wall Street as the place to be. When we look at the Russell 2000, it has broken up and out of its range for the year this week, and that is a really quite positive development. The transportation index is also starting to push higher in here. And I think this is meaningful, that we're starting to see some of the lagging indicators also starting to do better in here. The question, of course, many people have is what's going to happen on the political front. We still have ample liquidity coming through from governments. We still have it from central banks. The total quantity of money being printed is really quite impressive, and that is contributing to the continued move that we're seeing in asset price inflation. The failure of a number of the IPOs to really garner a lot of support will certainly be ringing true in the ears of investors, that things probably got a little bit too hot. What I thought was particularly interesting in here today, it's Black Friday, and Peloton seems to be picking up a lot of orders. It was up rather dynamically in here today, but more importantly than that is that it is started to push up and away from its IPO price. And I'm personally rather surprised at that. They're selling $2,500 pieces of exercise equipment and charging nearly $40 a month for online classes. That's a high margin business. And they continue to be able to function. Well, that's also an indicator that the consumer is in rude health. If people are dropping $2,500 on a piece of exercise equipment, I have to say I saw the Hydro rowing machine, which is very similar to the Peloton cycling machine, with $1,000 off on a Black Friday sale at Best Buy over the course of the last 24 hours. And I think I will be going down to Best Buy to have a look at it over the course of the afternoon. Best Buy is coming back up towards the upper side of its range. Now, it pulled back extremely sharply at the end of last year, and it has now recouped all of that decline. We're seeing a number of the retailers starting to do better. I think it's those that have been able to marry together the online and the offline are doing better. Amazon, however, is right in the region of its trend mean, and it appears to be pausing again from this level. It is, I think, representative of investors starting to look past what Amazon has done already and perhaps starting to ask a question, what have you done for me lately? fact that Amazon lost out to Microsoft on a big government contract, and that the direct-to-consumer model, which a number of the bigger brands are starting to engage in, well, then that is something that will be a challenge to the Amazon business model. Microsoft is still really quite firm. When we think about what's going on in terms of Apple, it had done spectacularly well, and it was at a new high earlier on this week. When we think about the pace of the advance, then it is looking really quite overextended. That doesn't mean that it's over just yet, but eventually it will pull back to the region of the trend mean, and that will represent a really quite significant decline before we get the next attractive buying opportunity. I think there is a sporting chance that we are approaching the bubbly phase of this advance, but at a minimum, we have had the resolution of a third 18-month consolidation. Each one of the previous ones was followed by a spectacular period of low volatility trending, and so far that's what we're being presented with in global stock markets. The rise of populism is something that is contributing to fiscal stimulus. The clarion call for populist movements is "What about me?" And the answer from politicians who are rather ill-equipped to deal with this upswelling of popular revolt is to say, "Here, have some money." So fiscal austerity is just going out the window, and eventually that is going to cause a problem, but perhaps not before we see markets doing substantially better as that quantity of cash entering the market lifts asset prices. Now, I did see something rather interesting in gold right before I started recording, and it was that the price pulled back extremely violently on the spot price. And I just don't know if this is accurate, and it's certainly not being reflected in the futures price. What it suggests to me is that we have had a bad tick in terms of the data for gold, because the future was in positive territory in here today and bouncing from the $1,450 area. What I will say, however, is that it is quite normal that when you have a moderate period of consolidation, that eventually investors get tired of waiting and they just sell. And that can contribute to the very final part of a consolidation having a swift pullback. That generally represents a good buying opportunity. One of the reasons why gold is doing better, why we have had this spectacular breakout from this lengthy range, is because of people being worried about what the future holds. People wondering about what is it that is eventually going to reach a climax in terms of the quantity of debt that's being accrued, and how can we protect ourselves? Well, when we think about what the potential for inflation is, CPI inflation is rising, and the things that people actually spend their money on have been rising for a really quite prolonged period, and this sense that inflationary figures are hugely underreported, then that's a clear rational way of looking at the market, that when people look at what they're spending on a monthly basis, they can see that their costs are rising, and yet it's not being reflected by official figures. Well, if anyone was looking for just a modicum of rationale for why we have a populist uprising, then that's got to be part of it. Gold continues to consolidate following the breakout. this looks like a first step above the base. When you get a first step above the base, it represents supply and demand starting to come back into balance. It represents the argument going on between the people who think it's a new secular bull market and those that are not convinced and think that it is a flash in the pan. As long as the breakout holds, that is confirmation that the demand component is in dominance, that people are willing to buy enough of whatever the asset class is to support it at historically higher prices, then that's enough to confirm that we're back in a demand-dominated environment. I continue to think that that's exactly what we have with gold. And if that's the case, then we're in a new, at least medium-term bull market for gold. That mine supply is still pushing on to historically high levels. Well, what that also tells us is that there is plenty of demand, that there is a clear bid under the market, that people want to own gold. They need and feel like they need to have a hedge against calamity. So I do think that this is an environment where gold and stocks can rally together. And in terms of the Dow gold ratio, then there is the scope that what we're actually going to have is a rangy environment for this ratio, where gold and stocks will perform, but perhaps not necessarily at the same peaks. When we then look at that ratio over a somewhat longer time horizon, the important point is that it is right in the region of its trend mean, and that there is a clear potential here that what we're going to have is a rangy environment between about 18 and 22 for perhaps the next couple of years, because gold has got a much easier time of rallying from current levels than most other asset classes, for the simple reason that it is so significantly further below its peaks than assets that are hitting new all-time highs. So it has the base effect in its favor. And that is even more true of the gold mining sector, where it is right now consolidating in the region of the trend mean. And of course, this portion of the commodity sector is also highly cyclical. The fact that we've had some commodities, particularly the precious metals, doing better, the nanotechnology sector, the biotechnology sector, the semiconductor sector, these are all cyclicals, and that they're starting to turn back to performance, then that is supportive of the bull market hypothesis. It's quite normal that we get cyclicals returning to performance in the latter stages of a bull market. I think it's also worth highlighting that in secular bull markets, they are occasionally punctuated by recessions, but the recessions don't cause crashes. It's during the ranging phases, the periods, the secular bear markets defined by valuation contraction, that when you get a recession, it can contribute to the very large declines. Well, it, I think, is quite likely we are now in a secular bull market. There will be the occasional recession, but it's likely to represent a pullback to the region of the 1,000-day moving average rather than the haymakers that we saw in 2000 or in 2008. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend. But I think the other point is, if we are going to think about where the risks are, then the epicenter of risk today is China, because of the underperformance that its market represents. And I'll leave you with that thought for the weekend, and wish all the best to all of you.